and let these people up on Capitol Hill know that if they sign these bills...
Hey, who wants to live longer? Go to superhumanradio.com today and listen to Superhuman Radio live at 1 p.m. Pacific weekdays.
Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply, it's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Hey, hey, welcome back to another episode of Superhuman Radio. It's Thursday. I was off yesterday. Many of you know I had surgery. I'm still a little groggy today, I got to tell you. I felt great this morning, but I feel a little washed out. So if I'm moving a little slower than normal, you understand why. We have a great show planned for you today. During the first hour, we're going to be joined by Howard Jacobson, co-author of the book Proteinaholic, to talk about what's going on in the world today nutritionally as it relates to protein consumption, and what role that protein consumption may play in the etiology of many diseases. Then during the second hour, we're going to be joined by fan favorite Brett Contreras, and we're going to talk about several different things with Brett. How to maintain strength and muscle while detraining, if you're looking to take some time off and cruise a little bit. And then whole body versus split routines, which are more effective and when. And then lastly, the thing that he did his thesis on, the usefulness of the hip thrust. So that's all later in the show, all about training. So please check that out. All right, we're going to get started right away and welcome Howard Jacobson to the show. How you doing, Howard?
I'm very well. How are you?
Wonderful, wonderful. Thanks for being here today.
A pleasure.
So with the release of the book Proteinaholic, obviously lots of people from different sides of the nutritional table came out. Many of them said the book was fantastic. Some of them decried some of the information in the book. What made you guys write this book? And I'm sorry, that the primary author, you're the co-author, right?
Correct.
And the primary author was
Garth Davis, MD.
Thank you. Okay. I can blame that on the anesthesia yesterday for forgetting that. So why this book? Haven't we had enough books out there that told us, say, you know, we're eating too much protein, we need to eat more plants?
Probably. The book came from Garth Davis, who's a bariatric surgeon out of Houston. And he had been, most bariatric surgeons, weight loss surgeons, are trained in sort of the Atkins world. Like, limit your carbs, eat lots of meat. You know, he'd written a book, I think it came out in 2008, The Expert's Guide to Weight Loss Surgery, and he'd said, you know, you gotta have your chicken and your yogurt when you're recovering from weight loss surgery. And by the time he was in his mid-30s, his health was so terrible. He was overweight. He was getting a physical for life insurance policy because they were going to have their first child, and he basically failed. Like, he wasn't going to get the highest level of insurance. And so he said, like, I'm a doctor, I'm well trained, I've been trained at the best institutions in the world, I work at one of the best institutions. Like, is this just my fate? Do we have lemons as bodies? Or is there something that we can do? And I heard earlier, a few minutes ago, when you're talking about, like, doctors don't understand the value of lifestyle and nutrition. Well, that was him. Right. He had never been taught. And so he started, like, just asking that question, like, is this the way it's got to be? Or can we affect our health? And like for him to ask, for a doctor to ask that question is pretty remarkable.
I think I wish more doctors would ask that question, quite frankly.
Well, I do too. And, you know, I know that I'm guessing that you and I may have some disagreements about some of the details about what we should be eating, but I'm guessing that if we look big picture, we agree on 99% of.
Well, I'm even willing to bet that we agree on more than that, but I've been doing this show for 11 years now. And what I've learned is, now finally, we hear terms like precision medicine, and we need to look at precision nutrition, specificity, and things like that. I think that a high protein diet may be a mistake for somebody who leads a sedentary life. I think you take somebody who's highly active, their protein needs may be more. My problem with a lot of today's nutritional doctrine, and I use that word specifically because a lot of nutrition is driven by beliefs and science that only supports those beliefs. My problem with most nutritional doctrine today is it tries to be a one-size-fits-all. This is what everybody should do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we might have a little disagreement on that. I certainly think that, you know, we need to modulate. Obviously, someone who's training for the Olympics needs more calories than someone who's sitting at a desk job all day. But I think we are one species, and there's a basic dietary pattern that, you know, I have never seen evidence to the contrary that the basic dietary pattern of a plant-based diet, you know, made up of whole foods, not processed crap.
Right.
But can I say that on your radio?
Yes, yes, you could say crap. We are family friendly, and most parents will say the word crap to their children nowadays, so don't worry about
okay.
that. Okay. But I'm not talking about calories. I'm talking about the macronutrient of protein in a person who's sedentary versus a person who's a hard training athlete. Would you agree that a hard training athlete needs more protein than somebody who sits at a desk 8 to 10 hours a day?
I would agree that the person needs more calories. For me, we went off track as a nation, as a society, when we started talking about macro and micronutrients as opposed to food. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I would like to correct is that we should be talking, like, when people go to the store, they don't buy protein, they don't buy carbs, they don't buy vitamin B12, they buy food.
Right.
And they're so confused about, you know, well, and now, you know, once marketing gets involved, of course, all bets are off. So now you can buy, you know, vodka with extra protein, you can buy bars with protein. So protein has become a fetish. And so kind of to get back to your question about why this book needed to be written, after Dr. Garth made his transformation and he lost a lot of weight and he got healthy and he got rid of all his cholesterol meds and, you know, he started running marathons with all the extra energy he had, he wanted to share this with his patients. And so he would tell them, okay, here's the diet that I want you to be eating. You know, lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts and seeds, small amounts of animal products if you want them. And he would they'd come back and he'd look at their food log and he would see, like, not a single apple, not a salad. And he'd say, well, you know, did you not understand? He says, no, I understood, but I need my protein. And this myth of this fetish about protein was crowding all plants off the plate. And he would have this conversation day in, day out with his patients. And he just became so frustrated. He says, like, well, I just want to have this conversation once in book form rather than having to have it every single day in my office.
Now, does he distinguish between protein sources? Obviously, bologna and a piece of pastured beef are very, very different things. And from a metabolomic standpoint, do very different things in the body.
Well, if we just look at, so one of the things we had to do in the book was look at the evidence for protein as an isolated macronutrient, which is very, very hard to do. And I think it's, you know, ultimately it's a mistake to say, well, we're only going to focus on protein.
Especially when the mission is to talk about food and not a macronutrient, but then a macronutrient is the title of the book.
Right, which is the irony, because
yes.
you can't get people, if people have this, Americans have this fear of not getting enough protein. In surveys, Americans said that one of the things they wanted to do to be healthier was to get more protein. So, you know, Americans don't understand the difference between, you know, different amino acids. They don't understand
right.
what protein is. They don't
right.
understand what it does. It's just been apotheosized to this nutritional god, and everything else has to bow down in front of it. So if you look at, like, the United States, like, do we have a protein deficiency as a nation? No, we have a fiber deficiency. We have a micronutrient deficiency. You know, we have a whole food deficiency. So, you know, the arguments about how much protein we need, really, like, it's a non-issue.
Yeah, but Howard, so, and to your point specifically, you know, people buy food, right?
Right.
And unfortunately, most of commercial sources of quote-unquote protein today ride along with some heinous, horrible ingredients, hydrogenated oils, highly oxidized proteins. Now, we just had a study just come out this past week that shows that oxidized proteins may be the problem with protein in general. And the more processed the food, the higher the oxidation of the protein is. So when we talk about this and we say, well, yeah, people are not deficient in protein, I agree with you. The guy who's pounding down three Big Macs a day, and then he's going home and having some processed, you know, meat product and this and that. You're absolutely right. But along with that is a sinister recipe of chemicals and stuff that shouldn't be food. How do you tease them apart?
Well, unfortunately, as you, we live in a world in which they can't be teased apart, really.
Right.
So even if you're eating, you know, your grass-fed beef on an organic farm, there's still these persistent organic pollutants in the environment. Like we've messed up our world.
Yes.
And so one of the ideally, we'd have a world in which if we're eating animals, the animals we're eating are clean. But as you know, it all concentrates up the food chain.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's like the ideal that we want to be doing, and then, you know, there's the reality of the world we live in. So, you know, I'm not saying that people shouldn't eat any meat, but just, you know, be aware that all the garbage that we create as a society and spew into the air and onto the land and into the water gets concentrated in animal tissues. And if we are the apex predator and we're eating animals, then we are the highest concentration of all these persistent organic compounds, and we can see what they're doing to our endocrine systems and to our health in general.
And I agree with you. Something interesting that I learned about when I was in California working with a group that's working on some cancer-related projects, we were discussing something good called deuterium. And deuterium is a double hydrogen-bonded atom, so it's H2O2 instead of H2O. It's O2H2. I take it back. But anyway, it causes the mitochondria to work a lot harder to break that bond. And it said that this could be leading to some of the mitochondrial dysfunction that we're seeing. And what we learned was that animals that are given, you know, potted water and irrigated water and stuff like that, and grain concentrates deuterium, corn concentrates deuterium, and soy concentrate deuterium, and animals that are eating these artificial diets and then fed to us, their meat has a high level of deuterium in it. When the animals are allowed to graze on grass, even lambs, they found this to be true, they don't develop the amount of deuterium. Now, I'm not saying that deuterium is related to cancer. What I'm saying is deuterium is related to the possible excessive load on the mitochondria. And we see higher levels of deuterium in meats raised in CAFOs and commercial farms.
Right. So, which brings, you know, the question of, like, you know, I know your show is like Superhuman Radio, so it's really people who are saying, I'm not part of the mainstream. I'm going to do something different and exceptional. And there's really, you know, one of the problems with science is that there's almost no research on the exceptional.
Right.
Right. Right. Because there's not. So I think that at all levels of exceptional, of really extreme diets, one kind or another, we really don't know very much. We have a lot of anecdotes. We have personal stories. But there's a lot of research to be done to tease that apart.
Yes.
But when we're talking about what's a sustainable human diet? So, like, if we got rid of CAFOs, and if everybody ate from, like, you know, Joel Salatin's Polyface Farm, which, by the way, isn't really sustainable. He's, you know, he still trucks in huge amounts of inputs. But if we could get sort of sustainable, you know, beef farms and things like that, the amount of meat we would eat, I estimated about, it would be about 3% of calories for a nation. And that, to me, that seems like a very healthy amount.
And again, I come back to some people may do well with that and others won't. We know the Inuit couldn't live like that because they have certain polymorphisms that because, you know, when we look at the Ice Age, right, 40,000 years of Ice Age either drove people to find someplace new or to stay where they were. Well, the people who went to find someplace new, they followed the herds and they hunted the herds. And they sustained life primarily by eating high amounts of animal protein and animal fat. So do we not take into account evolution when we talk about food and the appropriateness of diet?
Yeah, there's a really interesting study that came out that basically, you know, and every study you read, if you don't go to the original study, it's going to get messed up by the media. So the headlines were, being vegetarian can give you cancer. So of course this makes headlines because everyone wants to post that on their blog and get clicks. So I looked at the study, and it was a group of people in India whose families had been vegetarian for generations.
Right.
And it turns out that they had developed over the evolutionary time span a sensitivity to meat, so that they could process the essential fatty acids, the omega-3s and other essential fatty acids in vegetables more efficiently. So when you look at the Inuit, when you look at this group, when you look at the Maasai, you're really looking at evolutionary adaptations to allow us to stray from our sweet spot. So the Inuit can stray from their sweet spot with fewer health consequences than a North African. But there's still consequences. They still have a 10-year lower life expectancy than any other group in Canada. There's still a lot of heart disease. So the question we want to ask is, do we want to use the Inuit to say, well, we could survive on that diet, or where do we want to thrive?
This is an area where you and I probably somewhat disagree as well, because I think that everybody's diet is different because of evolution. And I think that Dr. Daniel Lieberman would agree with me. I've had him on the show a few times. He's the author of the book, The Story of the Human Body. And I think that those polymorphisms are seen today and very, very recognizable, like those who are lactase persistent. And those who are not, well, clearly those who are lactase persistent spent time evolving under conditions where milk was still consumed and dairy was still consumed well after weaning periods. And so I think that the Inuit are in their sweet spot. I think that the Maasai are in their sweet spot. I think that those sweet spots are epigenetically and genetically changing, and they're changing today. They'll be different 300 years from now because of the diets that we're eating today. And those people who survive on these diets, whether with medical intervention, which is something that's really affecting evolution today, up until the point of reproductive fitness and having offspring, we're going to see different dietary sweet spots moving forward. I don't disagree with 99% of what you're saying, and I want to get back into this. We have to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk more about the book. Is that good?
Sounds great.
All right, so stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio.
Hey, this is Carl. Start your day just like I do with a high-dose lipospheric vitamin C from Livon Labs. You, too, can benefit from Livon Labs' lipospheric delivery system. No more pills or powders. That's outdated technology. Livon Labs has the world's most efficient vitamin delivery system, period. Learn a lot more today at livonlabs.com and benefit from their new reduced pricing. That's livonlabs.com, L-I-V-O-N, labs.com.
Nobel Prize-winning research shows telomeres are an important part of preventing cellular aging. Slowing down telomere shortenings promotes healthy cell replication and longevity. This is simple, folks. Supplement today with the longevity breakthrough of the century, Telos 95. Telos 95 provides the only scientifically validated telomere support ingredient in every capsule. Save 15% off when you use the code TELOS95. Go to superhumanradio.com today and click the Telos 95 banner ad. Age better with Telos 95, the cutting-edge technology that's a leap forward in the science of aging, with research that was conducted by world experts on telomere analysis using worldwide patented technology.
Do you know how to properly use carbohydrates to ignite your performance in the field and in the gym? You will now, thanks to this free book by EFX Sports. The Carb User's Guide for Maximum Performance reveals why omitting carbohydrates from your diet can totally crush your gains. Ever wonder how many grams you need for your specific sport? Not anymore. We give you the critical number you need to dominate your competition. You'll even discover the super carb that's taking the athletic world by storm. You must try it to believe it. Go to getcarbolin.com/carb guide today and get your copy absolutely free. Once again, it's getcarbolin.com/carbguide. 4.6 million years of evolution gave us the blueprint for the perfect protein supplement for humans. So why do all protein supplement manufacturers ignore it? We don't. The first human-appropriate protein supplement is Thrive Advanced. Built around the blueprint of mother's milk, Thrive Advance contains the amino acids, peptides, micronutrients, enzymes, probiotics, and vitamins that support protein absorption and assimilation. All of our dairy proteins come from happy cows on pastures here in the United States and are low-heat pasteurized. You'll never find any artificial sweeteners, additives, or ingredients. You won't even find thickeners or gums in Thrive Advance. And we back up our label claims with post-production lab analysis that's available right on our website. Visit superhumanradio.com and click the Thrive Advance banner ad and use code SHR and save 50% off your entire order today.
A legendary name in hardcore supplementation. Iron Mag Labs. 100% original, patent pending Andro compound. The most effective, hardcore, groundbreaking bodybuilding supplements in the world. Iron Mag Labs, revolutionizing hardcore supplementation for more than a decade. Visit IronMagLabs.com. IronMagLabs.com.
AnabolicMinds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your questions. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn. Teach. Lead.
This is the Superhuman Channel. Evolution just got kicked up a notch.
Welcome back. We're talking with Howard Jacobson. We're talking about the book Proteinaholic. He is the co-author of the book. Is available at Amazon.com and where finer books are sold. And, you know, I want to say something before we move forward. I'm a huge believer in yin and yang, okay? I believe that when we look at ourselves historically as a civilization, we push from one end of extreme to the other. The goal is to find the middle. And I think books like this are important to make us ask questions to find the middle. Just like the books and research that says, you know, more protein is better. Once again, are the extremes that help us find the middle. With that being said, Elisa Profumo said, I have to ask this question. We were just talking about the concentration of all of these terrible things in meat products. And she said, what about plants? We hear even organic plants are now showing, organic crops are showing residue of glyphosate and other chemicals from overspraying from nearby fields. Everything is polluted. It's not just meat. What would you say to that?
I'd say that's true. And there's a big difference between plants and animals. First of all, most of these organic compounds are fat soluble, which means that if you're eating high carb, low fat, you're not getting them from even plants that are sprayed. The second thing is, I mean, the United Nations determined that the concentration of these persistent organic compounds in animals is about 70,000 times what it is in just like the grass if you went outside. There is a huge difference in scale, even though, you know, and I'm not in favor of Monsanto or any of this spraying. But the other issue is the more of our land that we allot to feeding animals, the less possible it will be to have the kind of local, small scale, plant-based agriculture that could thrive.
That's actually not true. I actually wrote a blog about, you know, I've asked this question for years, and that's actually not true. There are 780,000 unused acres of land in the United States that are for grazing purposes that are completely unused and represent, they represent 70% of the potential grazing land that's not available. It's not good for growing crops. It's hillsides, it's rough lands, and so on and so forth that we're not using today. But we are at 80% of all of the land that we can actually grow crops on. So that's actually not true. It's more sustainable than we think it is to raise animals. The problem is that because of the way our food supply is created, it's centralized. You can't do this in CAFOs. You've got to allow the family farms to prosper and use that land because that land has to be where you are. You can't move the cows where the land is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I disagree.
It's a fact. I went to the BLM website. I mean, I talked to people, and it's a fact. There's 780,000 acres of land right now available for grazing animals that's not being used. 780,000 acres in the United States.
Right. Well, that's not the part. I don't know that figure, so I'm not doubting the figure. But I'm saying that with proper agriculture, with biointensive agriculture, that land can be reclaimed for humans. You know, I live in rural Pittsburgh, North Carolina.
Oh, but you're talking about humans living on that land?
I'm talking about reclaiming it and regenerating it to grow. I mean, if it's growing,
you can't grow crops on a 45 degree inclined hill, but cows will walk up it and graze it.
But crops are growing on it. It's just you're growing crops for cows. We could grow crops for humans. It's not barren land. You're growing.
No. This is 786,000 acres of barren land, unused. No one's growing any produce on it, and no one's using it for the purpose that it was intended.
But Carl, what are the cows eating?
The cows are in CAFOs eating corn and grain that are grown by some farm across the country.
When you release those 780,000 acres, the cows are going to be eating plants on them.
Yes, the grass and stuff, right? But these are plants that are not plants that we're growing. These are plants that are just there.
Right. So I'm saying it's possible, and in fact, it's done all over the world to reclaim land like that to make it fertile, so that it's 16 times more efficient to get protein from plants than from animals.
I don't know where that figure comes from, but I don't. Think that's true. I mean, so another blog that I wrote looked at water consumption. Someone said, you know, it's unsustainable to keep raising cows. And I don't have the blog in front of me, so I'm going to paraphrase. But once again, I went to government agencies to look at how much it takes to grow an acre of soybean and how much it takes to raise a cow to 18 months old when it's processed. And then I looked at the amount of energy supplied by the cow or the acre of soybean, and it's so much cheaper to feed a cow water, slaughter it, and eat on that for a year than it is to raise an acre of soybean. And both of them are high protein crops. So I don't agree with that just from the standpoint of water consumption.
Well, so there's several issues there. First of all, the cows have to eat something. And as you know, we're in a CAFO world right now. So the cows are eating wheat and corn and soybeans. So all those crops had that land been transferred for human use, obviously would be a lot more efficient. Second is like, what are we actually measuring? Are we measuring calories or are we measuring nutrients?
No, nutrients. Because
soybeans soybeans have a lot more nutrients in them than cows.
If your pancreas produces trypsin, but only 35% of the American population produces trypsin and makes soybean digestible, that's why a lot of people get flatulence from soy. So and this is why I keep coming back to this. I don't disagree with you, believe it or not. Okay? I don't disagree with you. I think you're right, and there are people out there who a specific diet will work well for. I think specificity, and because of people's origin, their genetics, will dictate. But the other thing that we have to look at is their lifestyle as well. But I don't disagree with you. I'm not. What I'm saying is, for a segment of people, absolutely, you are correct. For a segment of people, maybe not.
Well, so here's where we have to look at science. And not simply like believe what we want to believe. So when you look around the world at the longest lived populations, they are eating high carbohydrate, low animal diets.
Who are they? The Hunza?
Well, the Blue Zones.
The Blue Zones. There's problems in the methodology in the Blue Zone. I've had them on the show.
But there's problems in methodology everywhere.
Yes.
So here's where we get into. Are we going to sort of cherry pick and look at every study you can find fault with? But when we look at the vast evidence, it's overwhelming in favor of the fact that human beings are designed to eat plants and that we thrive on plants and that animal products in greater amounts than, say, 5% of the diet cause harm. There's the evidence is overwhelming for people who are willing to look at it.
Oh, but look, there's research. Credible research on both sides of this discussion, right? I have a study in front of me right now. that's published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that shows that higher protein diets are better for cardiovascular health. You'll say that that's wrong. You know, see, this is the problem with science today. People pick the science that fits their particular dogma. What I'm saying is, what you're espousing is good for some people, but not everybody. And I think I'm a much more moderate approach to this. See, my problem with all of this stuff is everybody comes out with, this is the only way for humans to eat. And that's not true. The fact that we have the Inuit today shows that's not true. The fact that we have the Maasai that can survive off of drinking the blood of live animals instead of sacrificing the animals that eat, that shows that it's not true. It shows that we are adaptive. We are constantly evolving, and the diets that do best for us are the diets that do best for us.
But by the same token, someone can look at the United States and say, well, see, humans can thrive on a McDonald's diet.
But they're not thriving. 70s. They're not thriving. Well,
but by the same token, they're not, the Inuit and the Maasai are not thriving either. They're dying in their 40s and 50s. And when on autopsy, they have atherosclerosis. We are very adaptive species, but that doesn't mean, I mean, you said that cows should not be eating corn and wheat and soy. Why does every other species have a diet that's right for it, but humans are all over the place? That makes no sense.
No. I believe I'm stating that humans have a diet that's right for them, but I think that humans are much more complex than say cows.
I don't see it. I think we've made our culture and are more complex, but biologically we haven't had enough time to become more complex. We're primate hindgut fermenters, and we should be eating plants.
Now I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to take issue with something in the book where you compare us to the large apes. Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and I want to come back and I want to talk about this specific topic here, because this is really, really good. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio.
The number one best-selling non-hormonal anabolic agent at PredatorNutrition.com. Progenidrex has established itself as the category killer. If you're having difficulty gaining muscle while staying lean, you owe it to yourself to try Progenidrex. 100% of store reviews rated it at 5 stars, the highest possible ranking. And today, right now, there are guys pouring their hearts out in the gym with little or nothing to show for it. Don't waste any more time. Go to PredatorNutrition.com today and get Progenidrex, the world's absolute best drug-free muscle gainer.
What do professional athletes such as Kobe Bryant and A-list celebrities such as Selma Hayek have in common? They are all touting the benefits of bone broth. But unless you have countless hours to cook every week or can hire your own personal chef, you're probably missing out on these critical nutrients. Osteobroth is a high-protein, standardized, consistent bone broth in a convenient powdered form. Use promo code SHR for 20% off at osteobroth.com.
The category killer is back. Pro Synthogen, with results literally from workout one. You'll recover like you're a teenager again. If you've been pouring your heart out in the gym with little to nothing to show for it, you owe it to yourself to see the performance enhancing and cosmetic effects it can make almost immediately. One user said, I wish I could have tried it sooner. I just ordered 2 more bottles. And another, the overall single best bodybuilding supplement I have personally ever used. Visit CoachRobRegis.com or PredatorNutrition.com to learn more today. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it. Made by Hemp.com sells the highest quality products derived from industrial hemp, raw oils high in CBD, tinctures, and salves. You can also get fashionable apparel made from industrial hemp at MadeByHemp.com. CBD is a constituent of industrial hemp that has no psychoactive properties, but has been shown to provide a variety of health benefits. Go to MadeByHemp.com today and take a look at all of our amazing products. Use the coupon code SHR to save 25% off your entire order. MadeByHemp.com, your one-stop shop for all things hemp on the web.
There are a few products that I believe in the way I believe in CanSee eye drops. I've been using CanSee for 6 months now, and the changes in my vision are nothing short of amazing.
Wow, that's an old commercial. The truth is, I've been using CanSee eye drops for 11 years now, and I credit CanSee eye drops as being the reason that I do not need reading glasses at 58 years old. CanSee eye drops improves the quality and health of your eyes indefinitely. That's why I both use and endorse CanSee Eye Drops. Go to wisechoicemedicine.com and learn about how CanSee Eye Drops can improve the health of your eyes and the quality of your vision today. Prime Nutrition is proud to present Max HP, their most scientifically formulated pre-workout supplement to date. Now available in two great tasting flavors, Tropic Fruit and Raspberry. Max HP is the most ultra-premium pre-workout available and is made without any artificial colors, flavors, or dye. Increasing blood flow to heighten anabolic activity, Max HP is designed to meet the heightened metabolic needs of high-performance athletes. Visit PrimeNutrition.com and use coupon code SUPERHUMANRADIO to receive 20% off of your entire order. Go to PrimeNutrition.com today.
This is the Superhuman Channel, where we use oxygen for the power of good.
Welcome back. We're talking to Howard Jacobson. The book is called Proteinaholic. And I got to be honest with you, I think that most people do eat way too much protein. When I say most people, I mean the average American diet today. And along with those high-protein diets come a myriad of horrible, horrible things in many of those processed protein sources. And people need to be eating more plant-based diets. I agree with that completely. The only divergence I have is that I think that my opinion and Howard's opinion probably slightly different in the amount of protein that I think people probably need, especially if they are active, hard-working, hard-training, athletic type. But with that being said, let's go to the book just for a second here. So, in the book, you make the argument. The book makes the argument and looks at some of the great monkeys, the gorillas, the orangutans, and even the chimpanzees, and says, look, you know, these are very, very low protein, very strong animals, and closely related to us. But the problem with that is that these are hind gut fermenters. They have huge colons, huge large intestine, and they have the ability to extract more protein from stuff that they can eat that we can't. And in fact, when you look at their diet in the wild, the orangutan is probably getting about 200 grams of protein a day. But it's coming in all those plants that they can digest and we can't, because our digestive systems are so vastly different than theirs.
Right. Well, I don't think that the hindgut fermenters absorb more protein in their hindguts. They absorb other things. Even human beings have different sized colons.
Right.
And like we're the same species. So when you look at the just sort of comparative anatomy, we're basically frugivores. We're fruit eaters. So, like, if you look at, for example, the small intestine length compared to body length. So a carnivore is fairly short. The rotting flesh has to pass through quickly.
Right.
So it's highly acidic. So it's about 3 to 6 times the size of the small intestine. The herbivore is like 10 to 12 times. The omnivore is 4 to 6. We're 10 to 11. We're in the herbivore category. And when scientists actually look at what the great apes eat, they do eat some meat, but it's about 3% of their diet, which is kind of what I'm saying is the sweet spot for a human population as well.
But how do we get that high? How do we get that other 120 grams of protein from our leafy diet then? Because they're getting, they're getting about 200 grams of protein a day, but they're extracting it from plant sources. We can't do that. We can't eat twigs and thatch and stuff that's leather, like leather. You know, we complain about eating kale.
Right. Well, so the question is, you know, how much protein do humans need? And so, you know, that's a whole chapter in the book, and it was really fascinating to look over all these studies. And really, you know, what Dr. Garth and I did is we kind of looked at the history of protein recommendations, because, you know, there was a time before the word protein was known, before we knew what protein was, there were no protein recommendations. So, like, the history of how do we decide what is enough and what is too much? And it started out with, like, some guy looking at late day laborers and watching what they ate. And
are you still there, Howard? I think I lost you, Howard. It says call on hold. I don't know what just happened. Howard, can you hear me? I'm going to hang up and call him back. Let's go ahead and play some music for a second. Hold on a second. Howard, you there?
I'm there.
Okay. You dropped off when you said they were looking at day laborers. I found that funny. I mean, that's who they're looking at, right?
Okay. Well, because the universe sent me off I'm going to change what I was thinking, because obviously it didn't want me to continue on that.
Go ahead.
But basically the question is, how do we know how much protein we should be eating? And we now have like different labs that are doing very different sort of analyses. Like, basically, we need to replace, unless we're trying to, build our bodies or build muscle, just, maintenance is just replacing what we lose in terms of amino acids. So think of it as like a house.
Man, we can't keep Howard on the line here. I don't know what to do. We'll try this again. Welcome back. We have Howard Jacobson back on the line, and we have a partially good internet connection. I'm on a fiber optic. I don't know what the problem is, to be honest with you, but okay. Let's just sum up. How do we know what the right amount of protein is for a human being?
Right. Well, so we can look at sort of lab studies to say how much do we need to replace in order to maintain function, so we don't have muscle wasting away. So that you can do that in a lab. But basically, human beings need protein as sort of building blocks. And so if you think about a house metaphor, you need the most bricks when you're building the house. So humans need the most protein when we're babies, when we're growing from little to big. And the protein composition of mother's breast, human breast milk, is about 5 to 6% protein. So I'd say that it doesn't make sense to me that an average person would ever need more than 5 to 6% throughout their lifespan.
But yet you would agree. But you would agree someone trying to build muscle would need more.
Yeah, so as you're trying, but not a lot more. So it's interesting that the studies that looked at, like, who needs a lot more protein, and by the way, a lot more, it wasn't really a lot more. It was maybe a 1 gram per kilogram of body weight as opposed to 0.66. So, it wasn't like three or four.
But now there are some new studies that show some dramatic abilities for protein synthetic response at 2 grams per kilogram, 1 gram per pound. So that's I think the new research says the more protein you get, if you are I'm talking about bodybuilders too here, because that's who's really building muscle, right? Athletes. 1 gram per pound or 2 grams per kilo seems to be where the greatest mTOR and protein synthetic response occurs, when they're high leucine content proteins, by the way.
Right. Well, so I mean, the studies that I've seen suggest that actually the group that needs the most protein, aside from the infants and bedridden elderly, are ultra endurance athletes. They actually need more than bodybuilders. But so I guess the question is, for bodybuilders, bodybuilders are great at experimenting. The community is really into experimentation. There's a lot of supplement makers who are pushing various things. So, you guys will kind of figure it out. What I'm interested in is, for a person who wants to live a long and healthy life, like we can all do things for our sport that we know are not good for our health.
Right.
And that excess protein consumption takes a huge toll on the organs of our body.
Okay, let's do this. I want to move through a couple other points here. So what about your RDA claims in the book? In the book, you say the RDA is really what is optimal for people, and the government says the RDA is the minimum that people should be having in their diet, not optimally. Was that a mistake in the book?
No. What we said is that the RDA represents, and this is for statistics nerds, 2 standard deviations above the mean. So in other words, first of all, RDA is based on an assumption that more is better. So it's better to get too much of something than too little of something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an assumption, right? And it's based on the fact that nutrition became a science when we discovered like diseases of vitamin deficiency, like scurvy and beriberi and pellagra. So and those people were cured miraculously when you gave them a pill or a lime. And so all of a sudden, like, the whole science of nutrition was like, well, more, obviously it's a problem of deficiency. And if you think about human history, it makes sense that we'd be worried about deficiencies,
right?
Because we've grown up in times of famine. So we don't know how to deal with this culture of excess. So the RDA is based on taking what the average American needs, because it's not based, you know, the RDA is not based on your weight or your fitness status or your age or anything like that. The RDA is just a number.
Right.
So the number is the average amount of protein that an American would need to maintain health. And it's around 37 grams per day. And then they say, well, because too little is worse than too much, we're going to add two standard deviations, which means if you think about a bell curve and the 37 grams is right in the middle at the top at the highest point, we're going to move it two to the right, almost to the end, so that now our recommendation is actually more than 98% of Americans need, just so we make sure we cover everybody.
Gotcha.
So that's what we're saying. We're saying it's the average required for Americans, but about 48% of Americans, if they follow the RDA, are getting more than they technically need.
Gotcha. Talk about sugar and inflammation. The book has a more controversial position. Sugar is the new bad boy. Everybody likes to hate it. The role of sugar in producing an inflammatory response seems to be something that lots of people like to talk about. But you discuss something completely different in the book, right?
Well, so there are studies that show that sugar doesn't really have the same inflammatory response as we'd expect. You know, there are benchtop studies that show the C-reactive protein responses and other inflammatory responses to sugar that it appears like, I mean, first of all, you know, we're not feeding people pure sugar, right? So it would be very different. We could have this discussion if people were like going to their pantries, taking tablespoons and just spooning sugar into their mouths. We know that sugar comes with fat, it comes with artificial ingredients, it comes with all sorts of other stuff. And so it may be that sugar is simply a marker for a terrible diet.
Right. And
by the way, and we're not saying go eat sugar. Like sugar, like if you want, you know, if you want to be healthy, you want to eat foods that make you healthy. Sugar is clearly not one of those foods unless you're starving to death, literally.
Right. No, I'm with you. I see. I think the story on sugar is different as well. I think that, as you point out, there's a lot of nasty things that are riding along with sugar that we don't know about. Some of the evidence of that is seen in the sugarcane field workers who are losing their kidneys because of the chemicals they spray on sugar days before they harvest it, and then they burn the field to get the leaves gone so that they can hack at these sugar canes with the machetes easier. And these guys are dying from the metabolites of the burned chemicals. One of them is glyphosate, believe it or not. And they're losing their kidneys over it. And then some of that stuff has to be residually in the sugar. There's no way to wash that out. So you're right. I think that while sugar isn't the greatest thing in the world to eat, I think that there's, once again, difficulty teasing out what else is riding along, with the sugar and affecting people negatively.
Right on.
All right, so what about grains?
You know, I mean, first of all, which grains?
Yeah, right.
So
yeah, right.
Right. So, you know, there have been interesting sort of blind challenge studies for people who say they are gluten intolerant, and you give them gluten and you don't tell them.
We talked about it. It was done in capsules. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. So. You know, it's an interesting question. There are definitely more and more people who are having trouble with wheat gluten. I would argue that, you know, and we talked a little bit about hindgut fermentation. The big new topic now is microbiome health, like
yeah,
all the trillions
right.
of little critters who actually make up more of us than we do.
Right.
And so if we're eating terrible diets, we're going to get leaky gut, and then various proteins are going to enter our bloodstream, and the ones that kind of look like us are going to teach our bodies to attack us. So the problem with wheat may be because we have this epidemic of leaky gut that there are proteins in gluten that are similar enough to our own bodies that we develop autoimmune responses in the same way that cow's milk protein is similar to human pancreatic beta cells. And so there's a strong correlation between cow's milk consumption and antibodies to cow's milk and type 1 diabetes. So it may be that, you know, again, this question of you can't tease things out. It's the entire dietary pattern as opposed to like wheat is bad. Like wheat may be bad for people because of all the other things they're eating and have eaten.
I tend to think that too. And I hate to sound like a glyphosate crusader, but unfortunately glyphosate is turning up in everything, even things it's not intended to, like women's tampons. And glyphosate, I've read 24 of the 90 somewhat patents on glyphosate. Two of them talk about combining glyphosate with amoxicillin as an antibiotic remedy for humans, and all of them start out by saying that glyphosate is a weak antibiotic, strong antimicrobial. That's in fact how it works in the soil in killing weeds, by disrupting the microbes in the soil that the weeds need to grow with. And I'm suspecting that gluten became a problem for us when glyphosate started riding along with it and disrupting the gut, the way we know antibiotics have the ability to disrupt. And as you point out, then these molecules get into the bloodstream and the immune system goes, what the hell are you doing here? And then they look like other cells in the body that then get attacked along with the intruder. So I'm with you on this one. I think you're absolutely right about this.
Right. And we have to remember that 80% of the antibiotics produced in America go to animals for animal agriculture in the factory farms, because it keeps them from dying and it fattens them up faster.
I always say it keeps them alive long enough so they can kill them. So, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah. So tell me about, how long has the book been out now?
It came out in October.
And what have been the majority of the reviews?
Well, the majority of any reviews are usually positive, because that's who's writing them. But
right.
we've gotten some, you know, what's been really interesting is some of the negative reviews have been really thoughtful. And, you know, like, one of the things that I really appreciate about Dr. Garth is that he is aware that he has adopted a lifestyle. He's also become a vegan. And so he's aware that he has biases. And so he's actually on, like, more low-carb lists and forums than anyone else I know, because he's always looking for evidence that he's wrong, which I think is something that's sorely lacking in science, is people who are willing to say, I might be wrong. Let me try to reproduce this. Let me reproduce someone else's research. Like, you know, there's all sorts of disincentives to question your own results,
right.
which might have been completely a fluke. So part of the what I've loved about this review process is, you know, talking to people like you. Like, you've given me several studies that I've never heard of. Hopefully we can connect afterwards. You can, you know, get me references. I can read about them. And, you know, and as we've said, like, you know, the interesting parts of the conversation are maybe where we diverge, but we agree on 99% of it. And, like, you and I could both agree that if Americans moved closer to a whole food diet and we got rid of the crap and we ate appropriate amounts of protein, whatever we think that is, like, you know,
the world would be, we could avert a health crisis that's going to sink this country today. You know what? I've written this word four times on my note: education. So there's certain points that you've made that made me think. The problem is that people need to be educated. It's just like I said, what's the problem with grains? You said, well, which grains? It's, you know, it's not, unfortunately, we have the attention span where we want a bullet to tell us how to live, to how to do this and how to do that. But unfortunately, when it comes to nutrition, the devil is in the details. There's a big, big difference between a hot dog and a lamb chop from a lamb that's been raised on a pasture and led a normal life and then was slaughtered and made into lamb chops. There's a vast difference between that and the average piece of meat that the average American is eating. The hard part is the media is really, and I know that this is probably an extreme statement to make, but the media is at the core of this health crisis, because they love to run with contrary headlines. You know, oh, skip the gym and drink a glass of wine, because a glass of wine is just as effective as going to the gym. When you read the actual study, and I had the author on the show, he said, that's the most ridiculous thing. That's not what we said. We said resveratrol causes some of the same changes that we see in the body as exercise, but you'd have to drink 1,000 bottles of wine to get that amount of resveratrol. But the media doesn't care. And then they have people out there who go, oh, look, I knew drinking was good for me.
Right. Well, as one of my mentors, John McDougall, says, everyone wants good news about their bad habits.
Yeah, that's it.
And, you know, the good news is that none of this is sustainable. Like, regardless of what you and I do or say, at some point, the system is going to collapse. Like, I would like it to collapse based on conscious and, you know, intention rather than the planet just burps us off because we're too much of a drain.
Right.
But it's at some point we have to find a balance. We have to find a sustainability. And at this point, sustainability isn't enough. We need to find ways to regenerate the planet so that we can be conscious citizens of it again.
Yeah. Look, it's been a really, really great discussion. The book is called Proteinaholic. I think people should read it. If you are repelled by this message, you should read it and find out what it's about. Because I think a lot of people are like, look, I'm a high fat, high protein guy. That's what I am. And by the way, the methionine and high protein diet has been linked to advanced aging, but it can be balanced by taking in more glycine. But glycine requires the stuff we don't eat anymore of the animal, the offal, the visceral organs, bone broth. We need more glycine in our diet. And unfortunately, that's not a popular protein anymore. But the point is, this is a good book. And the only way we find the middle, which is where the truth usually lies in the middle. The only way we find the middle is for the two ends to cooperate in cordial discussion and find these answers. And I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care of yourself. We're gonna take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, we're hoping to have Brett Contreras. We're trying to connect with him, but having some problems. So hopefully we'll have a second hour show. We'll see what happens. Stay tuned.
Professional athletes such as Kobe Bryant and A-list celebrities such as Selma Hayek have in common. They are all touting the benefits of bone broth. But unless you have countless hours to cook every week or can hire your own personal chef, you're probably missing out on these critical nutrients. Osteobroth is a high-protein, standardized, consistent bone broth in a convenient powdered form. Use promo code SHR for 20% off at osteobroth.com.
Eat dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high-protein, low carb Quest protein bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest protein bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
The health and performance benefits of phytonutrients are indisputable, but getting all of your phytonutrients from your diet is difficult. That's why Prime Nutrition introduced PhytoForm. PhytoForm has nearly 11 grams of all the micronized veggies, fruits, fiber, minerals, and antioxidants you need. Alfalfa, organic spirulina, and chlorella, plus acai, pomegranate, goji, bilberry, blueberry, raspberry, cranberry, and papaya. Cabbage, spinach, broccoli, beet, the list goes on and on. You won't find a better, more complete fruits and greens blend anywhere. It even includes PQQ, which has been shown to improve mitochondrial biogenesis. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Prime Nutrition banner ad today and use coupon code SHR to save 30% off. Prime Nutrition, the best or nothing.
Hey, this is Carl. Start your day just like I do with a high-dose lipospheric vitamin C from Livon Labs. You too can benefit from Livon Labs' lipospheric delivery system. No more pills or powders. That's outdated technology. Livon Labs has the world's most efficient vitamin delivery system, period. Learn a lot more today at livonlabs.com and benefit from their new reduced pricing. That's livonlabs.com, L-I-V-O-N, labs.com.
In today's day and age, it's refreshing to find a company with values that match yours. And it's even more extraordinary when the products they make exceed your expectation in every way. That's what Michael's Naturopathic Programs has done for over 30 years. With more than 50 tried and truthful high-potency formulas, Michael's Naturopathic Programs give your body what it needs. No more guessing what herb or vitamin, amino acid, or mineral you need. With Michael's, it's all in one bottle. From cardiovascular support to weight management to nervous system support to detox and cleansing and more, Michael's Naturopathic Programs work. They have to. Michael himself has been giving it to his own family from the very start. You can find Michael's product at your local health food store or go to michaelshealth.com and get your tried and truthful formulation. That's michaelshealth.com.
Never before has an anti-estrogen been so powerful. The triazole formula is built on a potent, all-natural aromatase inhibitor called Pizole, which has been shown in clinical trial to be as effective as a leading prescription aromatase inhibitor. Pizole works in concert with the rest of the triazole formula to control estrogen while simultaneously boosting testosterone significantly. In fact, one of triazole's testers had a 120% increase in total testosterone and a 257% increase in free testosterone. Triazole is available at bodybuilding.com, NutriPlanet.com, or where finer supplements are sold. For more information, check out GetDS.com.
4.6 million years of evolution gave us the blueprint for the perfect protein supplement for humans. So why do all protein supplement manufacturers ignore it? We don't. The first human-appropriate protein supplement is Thrive Advanced. Built around the blueprint of mother's milk, Thrive Advanced contains the amino acids, peptides, micronutrients, enzymes, probiotics, and vitamins that support protein absorption and assimilation. All of our dairy proteins come from happy cows on pastures here in the United States and are low-heat pasteurized. You'll never find any artificial sweeteners, additives, or ingredients. You won't even find thickeners or gums in Thrive Advanced. And we back up our label claims with post-production lab analysis that's available right on our website. Visit superhumanradio.com and click the Thrive Advanced banner ad and use code SHR and save 50% off your entire order today.
This is the Superhuman Channel, doing reps with the weight of the world.
Welcome back. So I have to vamp for a while because we don't have Brett Contreras yet, and I really wanted to talk to him about some of these important discussions we were supposed to have with him about training. But, you know, I can't make people show up. I can only invite them. But there are a couple things I want to mention. So I've gotten a lot of comments because of my surgery. And my good friend, and I mean that sincerely, John Chrysler, who I know wants the best for me. Every time I post something about my surgery, he comes back and says, I hope that you will stop lifting so heavy. I hope that you will learn to stop lifting so heavy. And that's not what I'm going to change about my training. I want to be clear about something. I said I'm going to change my training. I'm going to start doing a lot more high rep, high volume stuff. And I am. I'm going to give myself more time off, too. Let me set something up. When I tore my tricep recently, I wasn't doing anything heavy. Okay? I wasn't benching 400 pounds. I was doing reverse pec deck for my rear delts. Thumbs down, palms backwards. And I have been struggling with a terrible, terrible case of tendonitis for a couple months in that elbow. That tendonitis actually came from me doing heavy dumbbell pullovers on a bench. That's when I started getting the tendonitis. And I think that that was what happened. I think that my where the tendon of the tricep muscle attaches to the elbow, it started to tear away from the bone and the bone followed it. And I ended up with a spur as a result of doing those heavy dumbbell pullovers. Fast forward. When I was in California working with Quest, I went and I bragged about this. I trained 8 out of 9 days, the first 9 days I was there, and I trained heavy. And my elbow started to bother me again. And so one day I went to the gym to train chest, and I thought, well, I'm not going to do any pressing movements. I'm going to give my elbow some time off. I'll just do pec deck work. And that's when I kind of tweaked my right shoulder. And so at that moment, I should have just took off. I should have said, you know what? My elbow's hurting me. I'm putting myself at risk. I just need to take off for a couple weeks. It's not going to kill me. I train a lot. In fact, I was hoping to talk to Brett Contreras about just how little work you need to maintain your strength and muscle, because I want to work that into, I don't know what that says. Elise is messaging me about Brett Contreras, but he's not on Skype. I am trying to connect with him. But anyway, but the bottom line is that I had a terrible case of elbow tendonitis. I shouldn't have been training. I should have just took off. The reason I tore my tricep was not because I was doing excessively heavy work. it was because I wasn't listening to my body. Anybody out there with tendonitis, know this. You have micro tears in the tendon. That's why it hurts. Okay? Imagine if you're going across a bridge and one of the cables, the little, each little threaded wire is snapping. Is that cable as strong as the one next to it? No. That cable's getting weaker and it needs to be repaired. In the human body, it means time off. So if you have tendonitis in any muscle and you're going to quote unquote train through it, you're a fool. I'm telling you, you're a fool. Take it from me because I'm a fool. I'm a fool. First class fool. Had I taken off, given myself some time to recover, I could be in the gym right now training and making progress. Instead, I'll be off now for the next 6 weeks. So the reality is that John Chrysler is wrong about the value of heavy weights. Heavy weights build amazing strength and conditioning of the entire human being, mentally and physically. But as we age, we probably need more time off, and that's something that I have to learn to do. I'm going to do this. I'm going to take one last commercial break. Sorry, I'm having to do everything with my right hand today. I'm going to take one last commercial break and hope that I can connect with Brett Contreras. So just stay with me for a second, and if not, we'll end the show when we come back. Stay tuned.
What do professional athletes such as Kobe Bryant and A-list celebrities such as Selma Hayek have in common? They are all touting the benefits of bone broth. But unless you have countless hours to cook every week or can hire your own personal chef, you're probably missing out on these critical nutrients. Osteobroth is a high-protein, standardized, consistent bone broth in a convenient powdered form. Use promo code SHR for 20% off at osteobroth.com.
The category killer is back. Mass Pro Synthogen, with results literally from workout one. You'll recover like you're a teenager again. If you've been pouring your heart out in the gym with little to nothing to show for it, you owe it to yourself to see the performance enhancing and cosmetic effects it can make almost immediately. One user said, "I wish I could have tried it sooner. I just ordered two more bottles." And another, "The overall single best bodybuilding supplement I have personally ever used." Visit CoachRobRegis.com or PredatorNutrition.com to learn more today. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it.
Eat dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high protein, low carb Quest protein bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest protein bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
Hey, this is Carl. Start your day just like I do with a high-dose lipospheric vitamin C from Livon Labs. You too can benefit from Livon Labs' lipospheric delivery system. No more pills or powders. That's outdated technology. Livon Labs has the world's most efficient vitamin delivery system, period. Learn a lot more today at livonlabs.com and benefit from their new reduced pricing. That's liveonlabs.com, L-I-V-O-N, labs.com.
From the makers of GLC 2000, now comes Actistatin Pro Athlete. The Actistatin formula gives you all four forms of glucosamine and chondroitin, plus Actistatin's triple patented delivery method to optimize cellular uptake and utilization of glucosamines, chondroitin, ascorbate, and manganese. Regenerate and maintain cartilage. Promote joint mobility and flexibility. Replenish lost collagen. Get 20% off your next order using the coupon code SHR. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the GLC banner ad today. Push the limits. Feel the difference with Actistatin.
This is the Superhuman Channel, where we use oxygen for the power of good.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. Guess what? We have Brett Contreras on the line. How you doing, Brett?
I'm doing great.
Sorry about all the confusion. I don't know what's going on today. I guess I'm not in the good graces of the technology gods, so that's all I can say. So let's start out, first of all, talking about something that the reason I really wanted to have you on the show today. You recently wrote a blog about maintaining strength and muscle mass with a minimum of exercise. So I'm going to have to take off for a while and come back and blah, blah, blah. So what's the answer to that?
Yeah, so the study basically looked at they had a very large amount of subjects. It was 70 subjects they trained for 48 weeks. So to me, that's crazy, just thinking, because I've published training studies, and that's a lot of work, 70 subjects for 48 total weeks. And they had phase one where they had them train a lot. So phase one was 16 weeks long, where they trained three times a week. And they mainly did quads, so the workout was three sets of 8 to 12 reps with leg extensions, leg presses, and squats, all with 90 seconds rest. So that's a pretty brutal quad workout three times a week. And then after the 16 weeks, that's when they split the subjects into three groups. A detraining group that did nothing, so they could look at how quickly they tapered off with muscle and strength. And then a one-third group that did the same workout but only one day a week. And then a one-ninth training group that did just one set of leg extensions, one set of leg press, and one set of squats. So they did three total sets, and one-ninth the training volume that they were doing in the first phase, weeks 1 through 16. And that's what they did the whole rest of the year. So for 32 weeks, they did either detraining one-third or one-ninth. And it was just very interesting to look at it, because they separated it into younger and older adults. And essentially, even with strength, so it depends if your goal is strength or muscle mass, but even the younger, they gained strength doing just one set, doing the one-ninth throughout the year.
Really?
They kept gaining strength. Now, they did lose a little bit. The younger, just doing one-ninth, they lost 1.5% lean muscle mass, but they gained 7.5% knee extension strength. So the older subjects needed they still lost a little bit of muscle mass training one-third. They lost 2.7% thigh lean mass, but they gained 5.9% knee extension one-arm strength.
So in other words, neuromuscular adaptation continued to increase, but the needed mass to acquire that strength seemed to shrink a little bit.
Yeah, they needed a little more volume, but the younger group that did a third, they pretty much stayed the same. So that if they did one day a week, they maintained what they got during those brutal 16 weeks. They maintain the size throughout the year, but then gain 9% more knee extension strength. So it basically shows that you can keep going up in strength while keeping, because a lot of the strength gains is specificity and neural in nature. And then, you keep the mass. But I mean, of course, if they would have kept doing this 3 days a week, routine, they would have kept growing throughout the year. But the researchers specifically wanted to look at how much you needed to train in order to maintain size and strength. The detraining group, younger detrained groups who did nothing, they lost 6% or 5.8% lean thigh mass and lost 4% knee extension strength, whereas the older adults lost 7.4% thigh lean mass and lost 10.1% knee extension strength. So it just showed you the younger and older subjects lost 4 to 10% of their strength, and then if you just trained one day a week, you gained the younger subjects gained 9, and the older subjects 5.9%.
Wow!
Just from training one day a week, and even if you just did one set of each per week, this is the crazy thing. If you just did one set of each three exercises, so three total sets a week, you still gain 7.5% knee extension strength for the younger and 5.8% for the older, which is a 11 to 15% turnaround compared to if you didn't train at all, compared to if you detrained. So strength is very easy to maintain. Muscle mass a little bit harder. You need to do a little bit more. But at the very least, it shows that if you trained hard one day a week, You could probably, and I extrapolated this to talk about, well, no one just wants to maintain quads.
Right.
What would you do for the rest? And so I talked about how I did a little experiment back in the day, and I was able to maintain my size and strength doing one workout every 5 days, one full body workout every 5 days.
So that was my question. So if I wanted to take some time off, if I've been training, let's say for 3 or 4 months, I'm making great progress, but now I'm getting into that zone where injury could happen. I need to kind of take it down a little bit. I don't want to lose any of my hard-earned gains, but I do want to cruise a little bit. You're saying maybe a whole body workout a couple times a week is more than adequate.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And I've seen this with my clients, and this is why I keep revisiting this topic over the years on my blog, because I see so many people, they'll say, you know, I'm going on vacation, I'm going to lose so much strength. And I'm like, why are you going to lose so much strength? Well, I won't be able to train, or, you know, at most I could maybe hit the gym once, and, you know, I'll be gone for 3 weeks, and I'll probably only get to train, you know, 2 or 3 times. And it's like, that will help. Train those 2 to 3 times. You won't lose strength. You might lose a little, the muscle mass you would lose, you wouldn't even be able to notice, but it would quickly come back. Well, I have found that you do lose stamina. You know,
yes.
Like if you do three to four sets, you know, and you come back and try and do all those sets, you will find that you're weaker on subsequent sets. But if you just do one, you know, when you come back and you do 1 or 2 hard sets, you'll find that you have not lost much strength at all. But if you were to want to maintain size and strength, in my opinion, you would want to perform, like say you did a full body routine, you'd pick the big rock exercises, you know, don't try to just do all isolation lifts, pick the squats and the deadlifts and the hip thrusts and the bench press and the,
overhead
lat pull downs.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
What about, let's talk about whole body versus splits. The way I've always used whole body is when I'm coming back from some time off, I will come in and do 3 whole body days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I'll do that continuously until the amount of work I can do and the weight that I'm handling has gone up so high that I can't really train any one body part hard because of the level of exhaustion from trying to hit all 3 of them. And then I break into a split where I start focusing on different body parts. So is there a time, is there an oscillation? Is there a way to use whole body versus splits? Maybe the way you just described it?
Well, this is an interesting topic because, if you think about it, and this was shown in a recent survey that was published like 2 years ago, in JSCR, and it surveyed like a couple hundred bodybuilders, and it showed that every single one of them performed body part splits. So that's where what are the full body training people going to say? You're all doing it wrong. So obviously you have to acknowledge that and say, look, almost all bodybuilders do perform body part splits. So that in and of itself is very telling. That doesn't mean they couldn't see better results doing something else. It just means they all tend to gravitate towards this. Usually they figure out what works best. So I'm not arguing that you can't see great results on a body part split program. But if you come to think of it, almost every popular strength coach and personal trainer in the world does full body training. And it's a lot of it has to do with the fact that we have our clients. We don't have our clients 6 days a week. We tend to have our clients 3 days a week at most, and sometimes only 1 or 2 times.
Right.
So it's when we train them 1 time a week, we're going to make sure we hit everything. We're not going to go, okay, I'm going to train your chest and make sure throughout the week you go train on your own, do your squats and
right.
your deadlifts. They're not going to do that. So we make sure they hit it all and we give them full body. And I've tended to notice, I train a lot of women, that I feel that they see better results this way. So the kind of funny story, Brad Schoenfeld and I, you know, he's been on your show a million times.
Yeah.
He and I have always argued, just kind of bantered on the phone. Whenever I'm talking about my training, he'll say, well, I need to get you on a body part split and get some real muscle on you. And I'll say, yeah, I need to get you on a full body program and get some muscle on you.
It's funny.
He training those lifts more frequently. And so we ended up doing a study on this, and we published it last year, I believe. And it showed just a very slight advantage for the full body training with muscle. Strength was similar between groups, but muscle was a little bit more in the higher frequency full body training. But there's a caveat to that study. All the subjects we had been doing body part splits. So it could have just been that there was a novel stimulus with them.
Right.
So it's hard to find subjects who have just been doing full body training.
This is why I think it's wise to use a whole body and a split routine to create an oscillatory type periodized training, because I find I develop a lot more conditioning from doing whole body training. You know, if I'm doing something push, pull, and squat, to do those movements with moderately heavy weight is very taxing on the cardiovascular system. And at some point in time, I become so strong as this progresses that the volume of work that I have to do on a whole body day almost dictates it's time for me to now split it up. It's almost like shifting from first gear to second gear. And this is why I think people who aren't switching between whole body and body part splits are really missing two things. They're missing the ability to build stamina, as you put it, you know, the energy output, the ability to do work, and then focusing that newly gained energy to do work on individual body parts. But also, every time you change, your body starts to grow anew when you go from whole body to split, when you go back from split to whole body.
And I know Brad oscillates, like you mentioned, for that purpose. Now, I do agree. That's one strategy you could use, exactly how you mentioned. Just start out with whole body for a while, push it. It starts getting kind of where you feel like you're not getting each muscle enough, and then split it off. I will say, having done both for so many years, it's like every time I'm doing full body training, I miss that. Everyone has those muscles that, you know, I miss doing deltoid day. I miss getting a pump in my deltoids and hitting them from all the angles. But when you've done full body and you go to body part splits, you miss, you're like, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah.
I don't even feel like I did much, like, especially on like deltoid day, you're like, huh, you know, I didn't do any big lifts. So,
from a psychological standpoint, I think that's almost, that's desirable, because a lot of people get burnt out. They train so hard, they get burnt out, or they get injured. And I think that's almost desirable. Like, oh, this was such an easy workout today. It's good to have those days where you walk out of the gym and go, I can't believe I did what I was supposed to do, and I feel like I'm not crushed.
Yep, that's a very good point. It's almost like a built-in system. It's a built-in wave-loaded in terms of effort. You have some days that are high effort and kick the crap out of you, like leg day and back day, and then other days that aren't so bad, like chest day and shoulder day and arm day.
You know what Mauro DiPasquale said the other day? I never knew this. He was on the show the other day. He said he made his greatest gains as a power lifter doing a 3-hour session once every 10 days. And then the other days he did stuff like sled dragging. He did road work. He did more cardiovascular-like training. But then he would come into the gym 3 times a month, and he would train for 3 hours, and he would do a whole body routine in 3 hours. He'd do his squat, he'd do his deadlift, he'd do his bench press, and he would do all his auxiliary work, his overhead press, for 3 hours once every 10 days. He said he made his greatest strength gains, and that's when he was breaking records in various world weight classes.
Interesting. Well, the take home with that is that he didn't just stick to this. Do this routine because I was told to do it. He figured out his own ideal training frequency. And I'll tell you, in my training, I've realized with the deadlift, it beats me up so much more than the other lifts. I can train squats, you know, 2-3 times a week, no problem. Same with bench press. But deadlifts, I've been going up doing one set of deadlifts a week. You know, I warm up, but I do one working set, and it's all out, and it beats the crap out of me. and just get it done and then try to repair.
Right.
Because the next week, if I did four sets, it just taxes me. It beats me down too much. But other people can handle more volume. I can't. Or maybe they haven't tried. Maybe they'd see better results trying my method. But Mauro broke free from the typical 7-day.
Yes.
You know, and that's what I like hearing that. Just, I love hearing stories about lifters trying something different because, you know, he would work out regularly, but he'd hit he'd go tax the heck out of himself every 10 days.
Yes.
And then he'd bounce back stronger. And that's what people, sometimes we get so.
Well, you just pointed out, the body doesn't know Monday through Friday. The body doesn't know what Saturday and Sunday are. The body doesn't know there's 7 days in a week. So why would you pigeonhole your training to a 7-day calendar? You could do a 9-day cycle, a 12-day cycle, as Mauro did, a 10-day cycle. I mean, that is one of the things, you know, we've talked about. Training styles, repetition ranges, weight ranges, rest periods in between sets. But for some reason, the 7-day work pattern is always stuck there, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, it's for me, I like to think, I've been writing my program since I was like, you know, since I was 15 years old, and now I'm going to be 40 years old. So 25 years of writing my workouts, and I've had every single week, I'll sit there at the kitchen table and I just brainstorm. So I've tried every type of program in the book, but I remember sitting there saying, what if I do best training full body once every 5 days? Or what if I do best training, you know, think about it. If you said you've got to go up 10 pounds on every squat session for 6 weeks in a row and put 60 pounds on your squat, how would you go about it? How many sets would you do and how much would you rest? And I'm going, oh man, if I had to do this same workout with 10 more pounds, I think I'd want to do it every 5 days.
Right, five days off, right.
Yeah. And I wouldn't want to go too long. I wouldn't want to go 7 or 8 days, but anyway, the point is, it may differ between, like Carl, you and I may have different, you know, and it may depend on the lifts, but to be thinking that way, to think outside the box, because you know, most of us are willing to go to the gym on a Saturday or a Sunday. We aren't necessarily confined to these 7-day cycles that make it nice and convenient, but may not be ideal. And I think sometimes people get too married to their
calendar.
Ideals.
Yeah.
Yeah, their calendar and their ideals. And, oh, I've got to hit this. And it's like, I've got to do every exercise in the book. And it's like, what if you dropped out this exercise and focused more on this exercise? You know, I've found that, well, because I help people, you know, that's my job, to help people with their programs, and they'll be complaining.
Wait. Your job is to take women and build great butts. That's your job. And we're going to talk about that when we come back. So you did your thesis on your loved movement, the hip thrust. I want to talk about the hip thrust when we come back. I've got some really unique questions for you, I promise. Okay,
great.
All right, stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Brett Contreras.
The smartest and most dedicated health and fitness listeners found anywhere in the world. If you're trying to tap this market of greater than 50 million health fitness consumers, you simply can't do better than advertising on Superhuman Radio. Our sponsors tell us Superhuman Radio outperforms other forms of advertising time and time again. If you're tired of wasting valuable advertising dollars and need a new way to build your client base, go to superhumanradio.com and click on the Advertise with Us link. It just may be the best thing you have ever done for your business.
Do you know how to properly use carbohydrates to ignite your performance in the field and in the gym? You will now, thanks to this free book by EFX Sports. The Carb User's Guide for Maximum Performance reveals why omitting carbohydrates from your diet can totally crush your gains. Ever wonder how many grams you need for your specific sport? Not anymore. We give you the critical number you need to dominate your competition. You'll even discover the super carb that's taking the athletic world by storm. You must try it to believe it. Go to getcarbolin.com/carb guide today and get your copy absolutely free. Once again, it's getcarbolin.com/carbguide. The health and performance benefits of phytonutrients are indisputable, but getting all of your phytonutrients from your diet is difficult. That's why Prime Nutrition introduced PhytoForm.
Phytoform has nearly 11 grams of all the micronized veggies, fruits, fiber, minerals, and antioxidants you need. Alfalfa, organic spirulina, and chlorella, plus acai, pomegranate, goji, bilberry, blueberry, raspberry, cranberry, and papaya. Cabbage, spinach, broccoli, beet, the list goes on and on. You won't find a better, more complete fruits and greens blend anywhere. It even includes PQQ, which has been shown to improve mitochondrial biogenesis. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Prime Nutrition banner ad today and use coupon code SHR to save 30% off. Prime Nutrition, the best or nothing.
What do professional athletes such as Kobe Bryant and A-list celebrities such as Selma Hayek have in common? They are all touting the benefits of bone broth. But unless you have countless hours to cook every week or can hire your own personal chef, you're probably missing out on these critical nutrients. Osteobroth is a high-protein, standardized, consistent bone broth in a convenient powdered form. Use promo code SHR for 20% off at osteobroth.com. MadeByHemp.com sells the highest quality products derived from industrial hemp, raw oils high in CBD, tinctures, and salves. You can also get fashionable apparel made from industrial hemp at MadeByHemp.com. CBD is a constituent of industrial hemp that has no psychoactive properties, but has been shown to provide a variety of health benefits. Go to MadeByHemp.com today and take a look at all of our amazing products. Use the coupon code SHR to save 25% off your entire order. MadeByHemp.com, your one-stop shop for all things hemp on the web.
There are a few products that I believe in the way I believe in CanSee eye drops. I've been using CanSee for 6 months now, and the changes in my vision are nothing short of amazing.
Wow, that's an old commercial. The truth is, I've been using CanSee eye drops for 11 years now, and I credit CanSee eye drops as being the reason that I do not need reading glasses at 58 years old. CanSee eye drops improves the quality and health of your eyes indefinitely. That's why I both use and endorse CanSee eye drops. Go to wisechoicemedicine.com and learn about how CanSee eye drops can improve the health of your eyes and the quality of your vision today.
Now, the number one best-selling non-hormonal anabolic agent at PredatorNutrition.com. Progenidrex has established itself as the category killer. If you're having difficulty gaining muscle while staying lean, you owe it to yourself to try Progenidrex. 100% of store reviews rated it at 5 stars, the highest possible ranking. And today, right now, there are guys pouring their hearts out in the gym with little or nothing to show for it. Don't waste any more time. Go to PredatorNutrition.com today and get Progenidrex, the world's absolute best drug-free muscle gainer.
This is the Superhuman Channel. Evolution just got kicked up a notch.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're talking with Brett Contreras, and now we're going to talk about something that's near and dear to his heart. Brett is well known to help women win competitions from behind. We all know that figure. Bikini competitions, when women turn around, if they don't have those nice round butts, they don't get the kind of points. And Brett has become the glute guy. And so for that reason, in fact, I knew about you before you and I even met, because when I was living in Tempe, Arizona, my niece was working for an ad agency called the Martz Agency. And they called me in because they knew I did this show. And they were like, this guy came to us with this device. It's this thing that'll help women build their butts. And I was like, wow, this thing is great. I even tried it. It was like called the burner or the burn machine.
Scorcher.
Yeah, the scorcher. I was like, who is this guy? This is brilliant. Oh, Brett Contreras. And I didn't even know who you were yet. It was years before you were actually on the show. So, I mean, you really are the guy who really allowed women to truly focus, and guys, to build on build stronger glutes. Here's my question. You did your thesis on the hip thrust. I have lumbar spine compression. It's causing radiculopathy in my lower legs. And so I'm hanging in an inversion table a few times a day, and that's actually helping. And I asked a chiropractor friend of mine, and I said, do you think the hip thrust is good for the lumbar spine? Do you think that it'll actually help me loosen up and build strength and maybe even be corrective for the lumbar spine? He says, you know, I don't know. And I thought, well, who else can I ask but you?
So I'm very interested in spinal biomechanics, but it's hard to just give somebody an answer because it depends on their injury mechanism. It depends on what's causing their back pain. Well, first of all, you have non-biomechanical reasons for back pain, which are prevalent, you know, like psychosocial issues. And then you do have the the biomechanics, the people who do actually have pain because something they're doing their movement is hurting it. And it can be hyperextension related or flexion related or just compression related. So if it's hyperextension related, like a lot of gymnasts get hyperextension related back pain because they bend backwards too far. Mm-hmm. They do that in their, you know, in their training repeatedly over and over. And that can lead to things like spondylolisthesis and spondylolitis and just injuries to the posterior elements of the disc, the bones in the back there. If you have flexion related pain, that's from rounding over usually from flexing, bending, you know, say you do a deadlift and you let your back round too much and you do that over and over and over and over, you can get disc herniations and things like that. You can get injuries to some of the ligaments. And so it just depends on the pain that that person's having. If you said you're getting, you're having compression intolerance, that's a tricky one because people think compression is like, oh, I did squats and they picture the bar compressing down on them. When I did deadlifts, this heavy bar in your hands and it's compressing down on you. Most of the forces in compressive forces on the spine come from muscles that attach to the core. So that when the muscles, think of all the muscles around the core and them contracting really hard, they pull down and they compress the spine.
Right.
So that will, the muscle forces greatly outproduce the weight of the barbell. I mean, I think you can have, one study showed, I think it was like 40,000 newtons of compressive force in a heavy deadlifter, which I think ends up being like 12,000 or something pounds. I think I was talking to Stu McGill once, and we estimated that you could get up to like 20,000 pounds of compression in the top deadlifter in the world, just by estimating his weight and the loads he was using. And the bar only, you know, they're only deadlifting 1,000 pounds, but you can get 10 to 20 times that much compression on the spine from the muscles required to stabilize. So that's why exercise like deadlifts and tend to be problematic because they require so much contraction out of the core, out of the erectors and other muscles.
Uh-huh.
And so can the hip thrust, so you need an exercise. There's not going to be an exercise that doesn't work those muscles at all that works all the leg muscles. You could do leg extensions. You could do leg curls, and those things are probably not going to irritate your back. But you want exercise that hit your glutes and exercise that you can do that don't irritate your back. So you just have to select exercises that you're able to perform that don't cause your back issues to flare up. And there are plenty of options. You could do single leg training, you know, Bulgarian split squats and lunge variations. You can do hip thrusts, especially if you, so I've done hip thrusts a million different ways and I can do 725 pounds for one rep if I want to, but I can also do 495 pounds for 10 reps. But then if I want to, I could take like 315 and just go real controlled. I can even do like 225 pounds for like 20 reps and be nice and smooth, and I get the craziest burn in my glutes.
Right.
So, during times where your back isn't hurting, go lighter. I mean, it's just like squats. I don't care who you are, if you took how strong you are, if you took 135 and just kind of did constant tension where you don't rest at the top.
Right.
And you just pump them out, your quads are going to be screaming. I think during these times, it's like, do the exercise, but go lighter and do constant tension where you don't rest, where it's just like a, you know, like a piston, just pumping out these reps, and you'll get a crazy burn. You'll get a great workout. But you're not going as heavy. You may reduce, as Brad Schoenfeld would put it, you're probably going to get more metabolic stress during that type of workout and less mechanical tension, but the most important thing is you'll feel fine, and the next week you'll be able to train again. That's the biggest problem with people is when you have to quit training altogether.
What does Stu McGill think of the hip thrust? I know when he was on the show, he mentioned, I think, that they looked at the, didn't you go to his lab and work with him?
Yep. I visited him and we looked at the hip thrust. Stu's a big fan of the hip thrust. Interestingly though, he brought up that, when I used the hip thrust, I topped out at 405 pounds. I didn't keep going higher glute activation as I went heavier. And that led me to this sweet spot idea to have me test all my clients. So like, as you keep going heavier, do you keep using more glutes or do you start, is there a point where you stop using more glutes and you start using more hamstring and quad and things like that? And what I found was that the results for me didn't match what I saw with myself at Stu's lab. And because Stu's lab, he didn't have a nice setup like I do. We had to get all crafty and MacGyver something up. I remember I have pictures of it. I was like pushing on a tile floor. My back was up against a board with wood. It was scraping into my back.
Yeah.
It was higher than normal. It wasn't ideal circumstances. But for me and my client Sammy, it was this linear relationship where the heavier we went, the more glute activation we got. As long as we could lock it out. The second it stopped going higher and glute activation started going down is where you went too heavy and you tried to come up all the way and you couldn't quite reach full hip extension. So as long as you can get the weight all the way up and reach full hip extension, for some people, glute activation keeps going higher and higher.
Interesting.
However, I had two subjects, Andrew and Aaron. They topped out at around 50% of one rep max. So
you mean where their glutes stopped working?
They didn't do any, they didn't contribute anything more. And this was fascinating because it's like, well, then what's kicking in more? So what we found was higher activity of all the other muscles, just not the glutes. So this is important because at 50% of their one rep max, they can do sets of 20. So if you had them do really heavy weight for 3 reps, they could get that same glute activation using much lighter weight for 20 reps, and they'd be getting just as high. And it's come to figure that Erin, I had her stop doing heavy weights on them and start doing high reps. She also had high activity with band exercises for the glutes. So I said, do these band exercises every day and do high rep hip thrust, high rep everything else. And her transformation is insane. She won her first bikini show. She won the overall. And, yeah, it was just phenomenal, the results.
So now glute activation and focusing on the glutes aside, there's got to be a value to going heavier, even if your glutes can't lock out because those other muscles are working. And having, you know, the hip thrust is a complex movement, a multi-joint movement when you really think about it. And isn't there a value to going heavier and forcing those other muscles, you know, to do some more work?
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I'm going to give you two different answers. On the one hand, I remember following bodybuilding for my first 15 years of being, you know, being a lifter. That's how I learned mostly, was through the bodybuilding magazines. And it always bothered me. They'd say, oh, I don't like bench press. I feel it too much in my triceps. But then they'd have a triceps day.
Yeah.
So I'd be like, what's wrong with hitting the triceps?
Yeah.
Or, you know,
yeah, do it while you're bench pressing. Why not have your triceps come up to strength with your pecs and your shoulders, you know?
Right. Or they'd say, I am not a big fan of squats. It makes my glutes too big. And then I'd see them having a training glutes. And I'm like, well, why not? why not do the squats? And it's just a weird thing I've noticed with bodybuilders. But, anyway, last night I was thinking, because I went really heavy on my hip thrusts for the first time in a while. And I did feel my glutes working, but I kind of felt like I worked up to 725. And that's the most I've ever done. And I'm at the top. I want to make sure I pause at the top for a few seconds. And I feel like it's going to cramp, you know?
You felt like what was going to cramp? You dropped out.
My hamstring.
Yes. Yes.
So is that the best way if I'm just trying to build glutes? Maybe, maybe not. So maybe I strengthen the hamstring so the next time I go in I can use even more weight. Or maybe I'm building bad habits and shouldn't have gone quite that heavy. I thought about it that a good way to periodize the hip thrust in training would be train the hip, if you wanted to really get strong on hip thrust, train the hip thrust 3 days a week. One day, train your ego and go all out and just use the most weight.
Right.
With reasonable form. One day, go lighter and try to use really controlled form, and then maybe another day with bands or some unique variation, which there's so many of them. And I thought that would be a good compliment, because on the heavy day, you're strengthening all the muscles that use the hip thrust, you know, the erectors, the quads, the hamstrings. And then on the other days, you're focusing more on glutes. But yeah, if you want to hip thrust the most weight, all those muscles need to be strong.
Well, if you're using the hip thrust, like I used the hip thrust to make my squat and my deadlift stronger. And it did. It was very, very effective at doing that, because when you train your glutes that way and you do that, the hip thrust, it makes you stronger at the bottom of the movement. And it's hard to convey that to people who are like, all they do is squat or deadlift. And you say, well, you know, they laugh at you when you're doing hip thrusts. And you're like, no, this will actually make you stronger at the bottom of the movement, where a lot of people get stuck. And so with that being said, I like to do heavy hip thrusts because I'm not trying to hit my glutes. I'm trying to make the entire hinge stronger. And it's not about the glutes. I know what you're talking about when you feel your hamstrings trying to cramp. Or sometimes when I start getting heavy and I get up above 400 pounds, boy, my quads, when I stand up, my quads from that static contraction, they're burning. They're burning.
Yep.
So I kind of think that there's a value to that, unless you are just, you know, you're just trying to build your glutes because you got to be in a competition and you want to turn around and you want people to say, wow, those are great glutes. If you're looking for strength of that hinge, I got to believe that going heavy is probably important. That's just my 2 cents.
Well, so you're talking to the right man, because we just got the first study accepted and we've submitted. So in the next month, I should have the link to put out there. And then there's two more studies on the way. So now we have three studies, and then I'm funding, Carl, out of my own pocket, I'm funding a $10,000 study that I'm going to pay for myself, just because I'm so curious, because I don't have the manpower to do the study here. But we're going to compare just doing hip thrusts versus just doing squats versus just doing deadlifts for 6 weeks, and the effects that that has on hypertrophy, performance, and all sorts of things. And this will be a very comprehensive paper looking at performance for sports. But what we're finding is, based on what we currently have, and it's not much to go by, but I think what we're going to find is that the hip thrust is better for acceleration, for speed, than out of all the lifts. Squats appear to be best for agility. I mean, it's got a very it's got a marked eccentric phase and hits the quads hard, and that seems to be really beneficial for agility. Vertical jump seems to be the deadlift seems to be the best for that. And then the horizontal jump seems to be the advantage goes to the hip thrust.
I was just going to say the hip thrust would win there too, because if it's going to help you with the sprint, it's going to help you with the horizontal
right,
jump.
Right,
right. Yeah.
But then with strength measures, here's what's interesting. So in the one study, if you didn't do front squats but you just did hip thrusts, you ended up gaining around half as much front squat strength as the front squat group by just
really?
Doing hip thrusts. And then with the deadlift group, God, I have to remember this probably, but the hip thrust transfers very well to the deadlift. Like I think you gained 80% as much strength as the deadlift group did. And the hip thrust ends up being better for transferring to the squat than the deadlift, and better at transferring to the deadlift than the squat. So squats and deadlifts don't transfer as much to each other as people think. Hip thrusts transfer better to
but
both.
But a lot of that has to do, in my humble opinion, I mean, I'm not a kinesiologist and I'm not a scientist, but in my humble opinion, that could be a result of the horrible form that 99% of us, including myself, use when we squat and deadlift. And it's hard not to use good form in the hip thrust. You're either going to lock out or you're not. There's not a lot of leeway where you can throw your arms up or move your back a certain way that's going to make you finish that movement any different.
Right, exactly. If you do hip thrust, you're working the hips. There's no way around it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so it also an interesting thing. We did two different isometric tests. One, where you put the first plate, you know, a few feet away from the wall, stand on it, lean against the wall, and push into the wall as hard as you can with your torso angle at about a 45-degree angle.
Right.
That we called the horse. I actually came up with that test for my PhD thesis. And that we called the maximum horizontal force test. And the other is a popular test called the isometric mid-thigh pull, where you have an immovable bar set at mid-thigh level, like in between the knee and the hips, and you just pull up on that bar as hard as you can. Kind of like a deadlift lockout, but more of an upright position to use a little bit more leg.
Right.
And I figured that the squat between, so this was the study just using front squats versus hip thrusts. I thought it is a vertical lift. You're using a lot of legs, but it's more end range hip extension where the hip thrust has the advantage. I thought that'll probably be a wash. No, that's not true. Hip thrusts greatly outperform. It wasn't even close. Hip thrusts greatly outperform the squat in building max isometric mid-thigh pull strength and also outperform the squat in horizontal pushing strength. So if you want to, for sports, if you want to get good at pushing people forward.
Like a football player, right?
Yeah. So what I can't wait about these studies is I've heard so many people, it's just reached an epidemic with what people think about training. They think that doesn't look functional, so it can't be functional. The hip thrust, you're laying on your back, that can't be functional. And then you could take the other stance and say, I'm moving my hips against full range hip extension against heavy resistance. How could it not be beneficial?
Right. And the only way to do that, because gravity is from north to south, is to be laying on your back. I mean, theoretically, if you could lock yourself into a device that would, yep, you could put pads against your hip and thrust forward with the, yep, same efficiency that you can when you're laying on the floor with your knees bent, your feet on the floor with your knees bent. You could do this standing up, but the problem is there's no machine like that. Getting, right, in and out of it would be a pain in the ass. It's just easier to do it from the floor up.
Well, and you hear the same thing with like Nordic ham curls, you know, where you're kneeling on the ground. That's a hamstring exercise where you fall forward and kind of lower yourself.
Right.
That exercise is very effective at preventing hamstring strains. So you don't look at what it looks like. You look at the adaptations it has, and it lengthens fascicles of the muscles and then gets them to be more efficient at longer lengths to where they resist strains. So I consult for professional sports teams. Like I did two different teams this year that I consulted for, and they'll tell me when I have, you know, we lost X amount of $1 million this year to hamstring injuries. We had four different athletes out for, you know, 4 to 5 games, and you know, their salaries are $10 million a year, that comes to this much money. It just when you put it that way, you're like, wow, okay, they have to prevent hamstring strain injury. So the Nordic ham curl is a very good exercise. It's not the end all be all, but it's probably the best single thing you can do for preventing those strains. But you would look at, the majority of people would look at that and say, no, it's not functional. It has to be standing. And no, you manipulate body position and gravity to kind of do the thing you're looking to do.
Right.
You don't.
Right. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. So, what else is new with you? What else is going on? Where are you going to be? Aren't you guys going to be over in the UK or someplace, or Australia or something?
Yeah, we're going to Australia in like 2 weeks.
It's you, Brett, I'm sorry, you, Brad Schoenfeld, Alan Aragon, who else?
And James Krieger.
James Krieger. He was on my show back in like 2007. Nice guy.
Really? So we just spoke together in the UK last month, and it's funny because Brad and Alan and I were all sitting in the audience, and I whispered to them, we were watching James, and I whispered to them, I said, I want James's slideshow. This is so good. And Brad and Alan were like, yeah, I want him too. And I said, I don't want to be that douchebag that asks, though. Will you? And we were fighting over who has to ask for his slideshow. But so when he got back, we said, James, we all want your slideshow. And he's like, okay, that's fine. I'll send it to you. It was so good. It looked at neat and then like high-intensity interval training. It's just so fascinating. I feel like everything clicked for me after I watched him present. All these things I've been thinking about. Why does this work good for so many people? What are the mechanisms? And just different things like showing the individual data on high-intensity interval training or weight training or, you know, or this type of diet. And
he's really good at distilling things down. I remember the interview that I did with him. I want to say it was 2007. And he had published a study that looked at the ideal rep range for the most efficient production of hypertrophy. And I, you know, it was like 8 to 12 reps, and it was a meta-analysis, and it was really well done. And, you know, that's what people want. People want the salient information. We're in a hurry, right? Just tell me, if I'm looking to build the most muscle, what should I be doing? That's what people love about Brad too. Brad Schoenfeld. It's like, it's about how do I build the most muscle the fastest? Just give me the details. That's it.
Yep. So James talked a lot about showing these individual, so you can report the means and show the average effect, but then he'd show these outliers. Some people, when they do HIIT training, they get hungrier, and then they just eat more, and it washes out the effects of the exercise. And then other people, it greatly blunts their appetite, and those are the ones who are losing so much weight when they do HIIT, and then they attribute it purely to the HIIT, when it's really HIIT's effect on their appetite.
See, I was just going to say, so it's HIIT's effect on their appetite, not their metabolism. That's interesting. That's really interesting.
And also how it affects meat. So some people, like, will do weight training. I mean, think of me last night. After I did my workout, I was wired. I went on a walk. I could have walked for 3 hours. My sympathetic activity is through the roof.
Right.
It makes me move around more. Other people, you know, go do some cardio, and then they're lethargic the rest of the day. So then it's a wash. If you do exercise but then sit on the couch the rest of the day, you end up not burning any extra calories.
Right.
So you got to think of the way exercise impacts appetite and NEAT. And that, it's just so fascinating.
Really, really. So when is that lecture with you four guys out there?
It's in Australia. I think it's like June 10th and 11th or something like that. It's in Sydney.
That's awesome. My birthday is June the 11th. I'll show up now. But no, that's great. So it's the four of you, and where can people go if they want, if they live in Australia, they're listening to the show and they want to attend?
So they would type in the Bropocalypse. That's what we call it.
What's it called? Bropocalypse?
The Bropocalypse.
Oh,
tour.
I love it. I love it. That's funny. That's really funny.
And if you search online for the Bropocalypse tour, you'll find this ad. You can also go on like any of our Facebook pages and see that we've been promoting it over the last couple months.
Okay. And if you're interested in building muscle, this is going to be a bond burner. You need to go to this because these guys, they know how to get it done. I mean, look at the studies that Brett is funding himself. I mean, I when I heard that, we're actually working with a football team right now with this protein powder that I introduced, and I'm thinking I got to get the strength and conditioning coach to listen to this show now because of what you said about the hip thrusts and forward horizontal pushing movement. I mean, all those, you know what? Football players are great at squatting and deadlifting. Let's get them down and let's do some hip thrusts. They'll be better sprinters and they'll be able to push harder.
Yep, exactly.
I love it. I love it. I'm glad we got you on. Sorry for the technical difficulties. I don't know. I think it a little, I had surgery on my tricep yesterday, had it reattached, and I think the anesthesia is still working on me. I'm not real fast on the uptake.
I'll take some of the blame. I got a new computer, and so I had to set up Skype, and I didn't have any new requests, but I turned my phone on, so I've done this on Skype over my phone. Because the ad didn't show up on my computer, so.
Showed up on your phone. How do you like that?
That's yeah.
Funny. All right, well listen, it's great having you on, and, hopefully one of these times when I'm out in Arizona, we'll get to hang out a little bit. Elisa wants to work with you when she goes there. She said, I want Brett to help me, do some glute work. I says, I'm sure he'll help you.
So we'll help. Yes.
Great having you on, brother. Talk to you soon, okay?
Thanks, Carl.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody for living through the technical difficulties today. Sorry for all the, mess. If you're listening to the podcast, I'm going to edit out the long interludes of audio missing. You'll know what I mean, those who are listening live. And we'll see everybody tomorrow with more Super Human Radio. Thank you for listening today.